You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education Issue Review podcast for the edition covering the 21st to the 27th of May 2015. My name is Chris Parr. I'm joined by Deputy Features Editor Paul Jump, Rankings Reporter Ellie Bothwell and News Editor Simon Baker. Are university staff on fixed term or casualised contracts struggling to pay the rent? A UCU survey suggests that about a third of them are. We'll hear about that in just a second. Is the traditional doctoral thesis headed for oblivion? Is it becoming obsolete? Surely not, I hear you cry. But Paul has been looking at this possibility and will report back in just a second. And we're no stranger to carrying concerns and complaints about the UK higher education sector in Times Higher Education, but it's the second best sector in the world, at least according to an international ranking out this week. More on that from Ellie soon. But first, Simon, our splash this week, it's on the UCU's report entitled Making Ends Meet, the Human Cost of Casualisation in Post-Secondary Education, and it makes for pretty uneasy reading.
The UCU have done a survey of further education and higher education staff just to kind of look at what they see of kind of this creeping towards more casualised contracts, so fixed-term contracts. Zero-hours contracts obviously is something that's been in the news quite a lot in the last few years. Kind of more at the extreme end of that. They're mostly staff in HE, 1,800 people in HE and 700 people in further or adult education. And according to Sally Hunt, the UCU's General Secretary, it kind of reveals the harsh reality of life in universities and colleges. And really, the figures they kind of found is that the people on casual contracts, sort of fairly large percentages, although you know in many cases a minority still of people, but large percentages of people were struggling to do things like actually pay bills, paying for food even, struggling to pay off loans, saying that a lot of 6% of the university sector respondents said that they were claiming working tax credits, which is something which obviously aimed at people on low incomes, 7% child tax credits. A third of casualised staff said they were struggling to get a mortgage. I mean, that is kind of, you know, a larger figure and something I suppose that you might expect anyone that's on a more casual contract, even fixed-term contracts. So if you're saying to a mortgage company, well, I'm in a job which is due to end in kind of a year, then you can see how there's going to be more of a problem getting a mortgage.
That's true in all sectors, though, isn't it? I mean, a lot of workers these days, getting a mortgage is almost a luxury in a lot of realms of society these days, isn't it?
Yeah, I suppose so. Getting a mortgage is a problem even if you're in a kind of permanent job for lots of reasons, obviously. But it will kind of be something that rings true a lot of people that are on more fixed-term contracts, just because it's the sort of contract which is more, understandably, more common in universities, I would have thought, because often you're hiring people, especially in research, to work on projects which are determined by grants which only last a certain amount of time. So it's in some ways you may see that is the university's only option is to kind of offer those kind of contracts, but you know this just paints a picture of what that really means in terms of you know day-to-day living.
It's funny, isn't it, because you see surveys come out sort of suggesting that academics are in a very lucky line of work, they should be glad to be where they are. It sort of frequently comes out in happiness surveys as being one of the sort of most desirable industries, but for academics on the ground, it can be quite tough. I know we've had stuff particularly about young academics as well, sort of alluding to what you said there. It can be quite a nomadic experience. You're going from short contract to short contract, moving from place to place. Perhaps not quite the desirable career that some people would have you believe.
Well, I suppose it depends on your kind of background or the stage of life that you're at, really. I think that's what it comes down to. If you're in your 20s, you don't have children, you're not kind of settling down anywhere, you're quite happy to travel around and that's really what that excites you as a career, then it's clearly going to be perfect for you, you know, and you're going to be able to sort of be quite flexible about where you work, where you go. As you know, maybe if you do have children, you do want to stay in the same place, I can see that that uncertainty becomes a bit more of something that's difficult to live with, I would have thought.
Absolutely. Well, you can read all about that report on page 6 and 7 in this week's magazine, and of course on timeshighereducation.co.uk. And our front page this week asks, is the traditional doctoral thesis headed for oblivion? Paul, surely it's the gold standard of academic assessment. How could you say such a thing?
Surely. Well, it's not me who's saying it. Actually, all this arose from a tweet that I saw earlier this year from no less a figure than Jeremy Farrar, the director of the Wellcome Trust, who'd just been external examiner in an Imperial College PhD vibe, and he'd raised the question on Twitter about whether it was, he said, is it time to look at the PhD thesis? Is it the best thing for candidates and research in the 21st century? I mean, his concern when I spoke to him about it was that, you know, the sort of ratio of time spent doing research and writing up is, he thinks, a little bit skewed. He reckons you spend virtually a year all told writing up out of, you know, 4 years of a PhD thesis, and he thinks that's not the best use of time and, you know, ultimately funders' money, I guess, as well.
Mm-hmm.
And the obvious solution to that is to say, instead of writing a thesis, people just submit their papers. I mean, this is obviously more of a solution in biomedicine than it would be in other disciplines, but in biomedicine, you know, students very often publish 2, 3 or even more papers during their PhD, and there's an obvious question there about why they couldn't just submit those and be assessed on the basis of those, particularly as, you know, papers really are very much what academics are expected to produce these days. I mean, you know, if they've got a paper in Nature, you surely say that they're worthy of a PhD, whatever else they've done. So anyway, all arose from there, and I had a look around. It turns out the UK Council for Graduate Education recently did a big survey of the extent to which universities were permitting papers to be incorporated into theses, or indeed to replace them entirely, and it turns out it is in fact on the rise. It's quite common abroad already, and even in the UK it's becoming more and more common, especially in sciences, although interestingly not at Imperial. They told me they don't yet permit it. So the article's really just to look at the pros and cons of moving to that kind of system.
And well, what's the ultimate answer? Is it headed for oblivion? What feeling did you get from the people that you spoke to?
Oblivion's probably not. Certainly not in the humanities. I mean, not unsurprisingly, the gold standard for them is publishing a monograph, and obviously a thesis is, sort of replica of a monograph, really, and often indeed gets turned into a monograph after it's been examined. So humanities is probably unlikely, although even there, you know, I did find some examples of theses constituting, you know, just series of linked papers. Oxford Philosophy Department, for example, which is a very prominent philosophy department, allows that. So even humanities seems to be moving in that direction. But I think certainly in science it seems to be becoming more and more common, although I certainly found plenty of scientists that thought theses had big advantages over sort of bundle papers as well. So it's certainly not a consensus there either.
Mm.
Theses, people thought that potentially gave more of a test of students' writing abilities, because obviously they're not being edited by journal editors or co-authors or anything like that. Potentially provide more coherent narrative about what people have been doing, and a better record for future students. So that theses certainly still have their advantages, but I mean, for what it's worth, Farrow himself isn't convinced that bundled papers is the way to go. Not least because he thinks that there's already so much pressure on people to just churn out papers endlessly and not pursue anything that doesn't have an obvious paper at the end of it, that he thinks this potentially exacerbates that. So he's not sure that would be the solution.
Mm. So two sides to the story, as you'd expect. That's what makes a feature at the end of the day. This one's on page 36, I think, in this week's magazine. And again, you'll find it online under the under the features tab on our website. Now, the UK is the second best HE system in the world, just behind, well, you might think the US, you might go for France or Canada, but no, it's just behind Serbia, Ellie, according to your article in this week's news section. Enlighten us, how does that work?
Yeah, well, first of all, let's look at the UK. I mean, it's doing so well because it's got a relatively low per capita GDP, but it really punches above its weight in terms of its research outputs and its connections to businesses and institutions overseas.
And this is according, I should say, sorry, to the Universitas 21 ranking, which came out this week.
Yes, that's right. And this is the specific ranking that's sort of adjusted for countries' average incomes. So the UK does well, and it's always sort of done pretty well, but it's risen four places this year. Serbia has risen three places to get the top spot. And that's also because of its high scores for output and the resources devoted to higher education. But there is a bit of a warning with Serbia because it's got a sort of unusually low per capita GDP for a European country. And it's also kind of, its research is very concentrated at one institution, the University of Belgrade. So that does sort of potentially kind of skew it a little bit.
That's the table with sort of adjusted for average incomes, if you like. What about the overall table? Which institutions come out top there?
The United States is top. It's sort of been top since 2012, so that's sort of no surprise there. Switzerland has performed well. It's now second. It was sixth last year, so that's risen a bit. Again, some of that momentum is because of slight changes in methodology in the ranking this year, which now accounts for the financial autonomy of public universities. But you know, there's no doubt that Switzerland obviously performs very, very well in a lot of the criteria, research and connectivity as well.
Well, all the assessment of that ranking, and hopefully technical issues notwithstanding, the complete top 50, both adjusted for average incomes and as it's published, will be on our website as you're listening to this. Before we go elsewhere in this week's news, we have TeacherBot, or Botty to his or her friends, its friends, I suppose, if it's a robot. It's been giving feedback to students on a University of Edinburgh course. You can read about that in our news section. We also hear from former president of the NUS, Wes Streeting, on how he won for Labour. He's now an MP in the general election, despite catastrophic results for the party nationwide. But that's all for this week's Issue Review podcast. If you want to comment on anything we've discussed, or indeed anything in the magazine, you can do so in the comments section at timeshighereducation.co.uk. You'll find us on Twitter, on Facebook, on LinkedIn, on Google+, all the usual places. But until next week's Issue Review, that's all for now.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.